Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and happy Father's Day to one and all. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Tricia Griffith. This is the Blog Talk version of True Crime Radio, Tricia's True Crime Radio, not to be confused with Tricia's True Crime Radio on the iHeartRadio network. Maybe I can get another network and do the same show and be even more confusing. That's my goal. Hey, don't forget, the show today is brought to you by the wonderful Doris Day Animal Foundation. This is a nonprofit organization started by the actress Doris Day. She was in Los Angeles in the 70s and saw all these unwanted dogs and cats, especially dogs. And she says, I'm going to do something about it. I'm just not going to throw money at it and walk away. I'm going to change things. And she has with her foundation. They rescue animals in the L.A. area and give them good homes, but they spread out all over the United States as well to do good. So check out their website. It's www.dorisdayanimalfoundation.org. Okay? Okay, good. And remember, we have legal goo that we must spread all over with love. Opinions expressed on Tricia's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Tricia's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from websleuth.com, LLC, and formsforjustice.org. In other words, if you get mad at something you hear on this show, you don't go blame it on the forums. You come to me, Tricia, personally, and we'll make you happy once again. Okay, school shooters. It's now common occurrence. We hear of, quote-unquote, another school shooting. Sometimes there's two or three in a week. Now, let's think back to when we went to high school. Okay, I don't think school shootings started until the 90s, and I'm going to ask our guest about that shortly. But I graduated in 1977, and I think we can all remember back to our high school days, and there was some sort of confrontation, whether it was two kids fighting or a kid and a teacher, and it was ugly. It was horrible. I remember this one kid. I'm not going to say his name because I can't remember it. He wanted to visit his girlfriend in class. She was a sophomore. He was a senior. So he just pops in the English class while the English teacher, she was trying to give a lesson, and he refused to leave. Well, the other English teacher, Mr. McAllister, came over and tried to take him out of the classroom. Now, depending on who you believed, he was either choking the kid or trying to grab him by the shoulders and move him. The kid said the teacher was choking him. So what he did was he grabbed the teacher's thumbs and he bent them backwards till both of them broke. I was not in that class, but everybody said you could hear it just go snap. Oh, it just hurts me. So then this little teeny female English teacher gets up and starts kind of headbutting him to get him out of class, and then he tries to run. So then she tries to block him, and Mr. McAllister is trying to get him, but he's got broken thumbs. That's what I saw was the attempted getaway. And then the day that Mr. McAllister had to go to court because they charged this kid as an adult, with, you know, obviously all kinds of charges, assault and somewhat things, somebody painted on Mr. McAllister's car, "Thumbs up McAllister," which I thought was mean, but kind of funny, but mean, but in a high school funny sort of way. I wouldn't think it was funny now. I'm way too mature. But, you know, that kid, that's what we saw. That was the big deal in our high school, is when a kid got physical, especially with a teacher. I often wonder if that kid would have been a school shooter. You know, if he would have gotten angry enough to come in. He certainly was. He looked like he could kill somebody that day. The problem is that these kids think that's the solution. And there is a debate going on. You know, I asked Mark Klass to come on, and he was not available to discuss this with us. But he said something to me that was interesting, and I'm going to ask my guest about it as well. And that is, there are two sides to this debate. One is, there are people convinced that gun control, that's the problem. We just get the guns out of the kids' hands, and that'll take care of it. And other people believe it's a mental illness issue, and we need to take care of the problem before they pick up the gun. And that's where I fall. I fall on that side, that it is a mental health issue that needs to be dealt with first. Then we won't have to worry about the guns. My guest tonight, he was gracious enough to appear on my iHeartRadio show on Thursday, and we just barely scratched the surface of school shooters. My guest is Dr. Peter Langman. He is the authority when it comes to school shooters. He has a book out called Why Kids Kill: Inside the Minds of School Shooters, and he has a new book coming out in about 7 months called School Shooters: Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators. Dr. Langman, thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, good. Well, we have lots to talk about. We're just going to kind of go over a little bit what we touched on Thursday, and that is, let's just talk about why. Why do kids become school shooters? What in the world makes them think it's a thing to do to solve their problem to pick up a gun and go kill people?
Well, you know, it's a very profound question, and unfortunately there's no simple answer. And I think what we often see in the media is people wanting to blame it on one thing, to simplify it. And my focus is on doing it justice and recognizing that it's more complex than any one cause and any one solution. So when we're talking about school shooters, if there's one thing we can say that's true for just about all of them, it's that they're full of rage. But mm-hmm. why they're full of rage varies dramatically, and why they're committing their attacks varies dramatically. And the attacks themselves are very different. Some are targeted against specific people that the perpetrator has a grievance against, and others mm-hmm. are just completely random attacks where the perpetrator walks into a school setting, whether it's a lobby, a cafeteria, classroom, auditorium, and just opens fire indiscriminately. And sometimes there's an element of both types, where there's a particular targeted victim, and then having shot that person, the perpetrator opens fire randomly. So the attacks vary, the perpetrators vary, and their motivations vary.
Well, I have an email from an old high school friend of mine, Dave. He just sent me an email and said, Trish, there was a famous school shooting in January 1979 that inspired the Boomtown Rats song, Tell Me Why I Don't Like Mondays. It happened in San Diego. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you remember that? Because I don't.
Yes, that was Brenda Spencer. She was a 16-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
Brenda had a history of some antisocial behavior or conduct disorder problems. She had previously vandalized her school along with a friend. She had shot out some windows with a BB gun, and she and this friend reportedly had broken inside and done some vandalism inside the school as well. She got a gun for Christmas 1978 from her father, who was an ex-military man. And Brenda had wanted a rifle for a long time. Her fantasy actually had been to grow up to become a sniper, and she was particularly interested in killing police officers.
Oh, my God. What a Christmas gift to give your daughter. So obviously her father had no idea that she was this sick, right?
Right. He had, you know, raised her to know how to use firearms, know about gun safety. He had trained her. She was a very skilled marksman, and she was pushing to get a gun for a long time. After getting her Christmas present, she was telling her friends something big was going to happen, and they would probably see her on television. And then just over a month later, on January 29th, 1979, she committed a sniper attack against her former elementary school from the safety of her own house. She lived directly across from the school. So she had aspired to become a sniper, and at age 16, that's what she did.
Did she kill anybody?
She killed two and wounded nine, mostly kids. One of the deaths was the principal of the school. She wounded a police officer who arrived on the scene and was hoping to kill more.
Dr. Langman, you say the shooter, this was back in 1979. She was a female, which is unusual in itself, but she was only 16. Back in 1979, I have to believe she might be out and about now. Is she? Do you know?
No, she's not. She's come up for parole a number of times, and agency has never been released.
Well, that's good, because correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, but when somebody gets to that point, don't you think that their form, they have a personality disorder, which some people believe cannot be changed, and therefore they will always be a danger to society? Is that a correct statement, or am I overstepping it? Am I making it too large?
You know, it's hard to say that someone, once a danger, is always a danger, especially when they're a danger at such a young age. But I did see her, or I do see her as having most likely a psychopathic personality. And that's something that is what you might call a stable condition. It's not just a depression that someone might come out of. If it's built into her personality to be cold-blooded, sadistic, not to have empathy, those qualities probably are not going to change much over time.
And what would happen to a child like that? Why at 16 would she have those types of signs already appearing? Do you know what her childhood was like?
I know a little bit about it. Her parents had divorced around the age of 9, when she was 9. She had two older siblings, a brother and a sister. For some reason, all three children went with the father, and that has not been released as to, you know, what was said, what was discussed during the court hearing. But I guess the two older ones wanted to go with the father, and the judge wanted to keep the three children together, so Brenda went with them as well. There's no indication that she was an abused child or that there was significant dysfunction in the home. Later, like 22 years after her attack, she claimed that her father had beaten her and committed incest with her. Now, that was at a parole hearing, and she had told multiple lies at a previous parole hearing as well as at this one, and the parole board pointed out to her, well, that's funny that you should say that because you've never once discussed that in your counseling sessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she said, well, I tried, but they didn't want to listen, and the board did not buy it. So apart from her testimony 22 years after her attack, in which she was apparently trying to play on the board's sympathy, there's no indication that she was an abused child.
Exactly. But there's other types of abuse, as you know. Verbal abuse can be just as harsh, if not more detrimental at times to small children. So we don't know. And again, when I bring this up, Dr. Langman, I don't want to blame the parents. I'm just trying to find the cause so we can learn not to do whatever it is that's being done to where these kids turn out this way. There are some people who argue that they were born that way. I don't know if that's true. I don't think we have enough information on that yet. But it is imperative. Not all kids that are abused emotionally, I'm not even talking physically, but not all kids that are abused emotionally, in fact, I'd say the greater majority of them, they don't go out to become shooters. So what happens are killers or criminals. So it's kind of like you have to figure out what happened in this case. Where are these triggers that are causing this group of children who've experienced probably less abuse than others to pick up a gun and start shooting? And I think that's imperative that we discuss that, or not discuss it, but at least find the answer. My friend Dave just sent me another email. They said when they asked her why she did it, she said because she hated Mondays. Wow. Go ahead, doctor.
Yeah, I was going to say the story of how that attack played out is really remarkable, and it says a lot about the character of Brenda Spencer. A quick thinking reporter realized that there was, you know, a neighborhood right by the school, and he wanted to call someone to get an on-the-scene witness. So he figured out what house was directly across from the school, and he called that house. That was Brenda Spencer's house.
Oh,
the reporter did not know he was calling the perpetrator. And Brenda picked up the phone, and he quickly found out by talking to her that she was the one doing the shooting. And she was laughing, giggling. She bantered with them. She said, yeah, it's just something to, you know, brighten up a boring Monday. I don't like Mondays. She was completely calm. She was not angry. I said earlier, almost every school shooter was full of rage. In her case, she she seemed to be maybe the only one who wasn't, that this was entertaining. She got a kick out of shooting people, saw little children writhing on the ground who had been shot, and thought that was funny. So for her, the whole thing was like an adventure, an entertaining activity.
That is just as twisted as you can be. And to think, like one of our people in our chat room, Mrs. Nora, said Brenda had a song written about her. So she was probably enjoying the spotlight, don't you think?
Definitely. She later was talking to a police officer on the phone. There was a long standoff after the police arrived, and they had a SWAT team, and the house was being circled by a helicopter, and, you know, it was a very tense situation. But again, she was talking to the police officer and laughing. She asked if there were news reporters in the area, and when told yes, she thought, you know, great. She was eager to be on television. It was like she told her friend, something big's going to happen. You're going to see me on TV. And she loved
it. Oh, my God. So she was kind of the precursor to all of the other warnings that we now know that people are to watch out for, and that is, you know, you're going to see me in the news, I'm going to do something big, don't come to school, or, you know, the warnings that are there that now we take very seriously. I'd like to tell everybody there is a great show on Sword, SWORD, and scale.com. And it's called I Don't Like Mondays, and it's about Brenda Spencer. My good friend Mike did that in April of this year, April 9th, 2014. So if you want to hear more about the Brenda Spencer story, go to swordandscale.com and look up, you can search Brenda Spencer. But it's April 9th, and the show is called I Don't Like Mondays. And I'm telling you, Sword and Scale, excellent show. Be sure and listen to it. Okay, Dr. Langman, let's go forward here a little bit and talk about the latest school shootings. And when I say latest, I mean like, you know, a few days ago. And that is what is so tragic, is they are just a few days ago. So can you give us a background of the last two? Weren't there two fairly close together?
There was one at Seattle Pacific University, and that was committed by Aaron Ibarra. And there was one in Oregon, and that was, I believe it was John Michael Padgett, P-A-D-G-E-T-T, was the perpetrator there.
And how were they similar? Were they connected in any way as far as the similarities, or were they just two totally different reasons for the school shooting?
Oh, by the way, I said John Michael Padgett. It was Jared Michael Padgett.
Jared. Okay.
Yeah, I have not seen anything linking those two attacks. And just, again, within the last couple of weeks, there was also two attacks against police officers, one in this country by Gerard and Amanda Miller, and one in Canada where someone specifically targeted police officers. So beyond just school shootings in the last few weeks, there have been other multiple victim attacks. And yet I haven't seen anything linking one to the other. No one directly attributed an influence or, you know, identified someone as a role model.
There was a recent shooting by the Santa Barbara University of California, Santa Barbara. It was the assistant director's son. He was the assistant director on, was it the Hunger Games or... Did you see that videotape of the kid that he made of himself talking about how he's going to get even with everybody? What was your opinion on that? And then we're going to get back. I mean, they're pretty much the same thing. He just didn't go to his high school. He just waited till he was older and then went to the college.
Right. That was Elliot Roger, and he was 22 at the time of the attack. And he showed a lot of different traits that I would see as some suggesting elements of a psychopathic personality, but others suggesting more of a psychotic disorder, something mild like schizotypal personality disorder, not a full-blown schizophrenia. And I try not to get too lost in psychobabble, but if you're talking diagnostically, those are some of the things I saw in him. And if you want, I can explain what I mean by those.
I would like you to, because I think what you're saying is one is has symptoms of a sociopath or a schizophrenia, and the other is full-blown. I'm not sure if that's true, but can you give us a definition of both those terms, please?
Okay. Schizophrenia is a very severe psychotic disorder that's characterized by hallucinations, which are sensory experiences that are not real, such as seeing things or hearing things that are not there, and or delusions, which are false beliefs, such as paranoid delusions, thinking there's a plot or, you know, people are out to get you, or delusions of grandeur, thinking you're some exalted being. And people with schizophrenia tend to have severely impaired social and emotional functioning. Now, schizotypal personality disorder is not that extreme. So people may have some unusual experiences. They may have some odd thoughts. They may get lost in fantasy and kind of lose touch with reality, but generally not to the point of full-blown delusions or hallucinations.
When you say get lost in reality, that you kind of describe me when I'm daydreaming. am I schizotypal or whatever it is, or
get lost in daydreams, but that's not the same as losing touch with reality. For example, in Elliot Rodger's final video, and even more so in his 137-page essentially autobiography that he sent to people, we see some unusual thoughts and some very grandiose thoughts. He writes about himself as God. I will punish them like God. I'm the closest thing on earth to a living God. I am the supreme gentleman. He had this exalted view of himself, refers to himself as divine. So you see, whether you could call it delusions of grandeur, or maybe he didn't fully believe it, but he was kind of getting lost in his imagination, so he's writing it as if he believes it. And without him alive to question about this, you know, we have to be careful about coming to final conclusions, but clearly he had grandiose ideas about himself. So when I say not fully in touch with reality, that's one of the aspects I'm referring to.
Got it. I'm just trying to get all my shooters in a row here. Hold on one second. So let me ask you about Elliot Rodger real quickly again. It seems like the kid had everything. You know, they had money, they had anything at their fingertips. He could have been a real popular kid because his dad was working on famous movies all the time. So why? I mean, what could have happened? It's really hard, I know, to say what could have happened behind closed doors because you have no idea. But give us perhaps examples, because we look at these parents and we say they seem normal, they don't seem horrible, and no parent is perfect. So what do you think happened?
Well, this goes back to your question earlier about Brenda Spencer or, you know, people like that in general. Are they born or are they made? And often the answer is, well, it's partly each, but I have not seen anything to suggest that his parents, as you said, were horrible parents. They weren't perfect. They got divorced. He had a stepmother. He wasn't thrilled with his stepmother. But even in his autobiography, he didn't make serious allegations of mistreatment. They didn't get along. They had some issues.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like he came into this world with some significant deficits. So he didn't have a solid sense of identity. And he was profoundly envious and jealous, and he writes about that in his document. And he had poor social skills. And this became damaging, devastating, as he hit adolescence. And he was, you know, so desperate to have a girlfriend. Talked about love, talked about sex constantly in his document. He saw other people succeeding where he wasn't, and that made him feel, on the one hand, profoundly inferior, and I think that's what kind of drove his fantasies of being this all-powerful being to compensate for that profound sense of inferiority. But this is where the psychopathic aspects come in. Not that he was what you would call a full-blown psychopath, a classic psychopath, but he was profoundly narcissistic and profoundly lacking in empathy and very entitled. And he thought he should have what he wanted. And when he didn't get it, it enraged him. And when he saw other people getting it, it enraged him. He even fantasized, or more than fantasized, seriously considered murdering his much younger half-brother because his little brother was socially successful, and Elliot couldn't stand the thought that his little brother would grow up and have a girlfriend. So he was planning on killing him.
That is just so bizarre. You have to wonder what switch in that kid's brain flipped to turn this way when the other kids all had the same upbringing. I saw him and I thought, I wonder, and again, this is just so, I have nothing to base this on other than just looking at him. I thought maybe he might have a slight case of Asperger's, and that made it uncomfortable for other people to be around him. Is that a possibility?
Yes, and that was apparently something that was either mentioned or diagnosed, you know, years ago. That's
one way of understanding
his social deficits. But going back to the idea of the schizotypal personality, they also have social deficits. And it's not just a matter of being shy, reserved, inhibited. There's something, again, profoundly missing in their ability to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Asperger's could account for it. Something else could account for it. Whatever we call it, whatever label we put on it, the issue is the same, that
he could not
converse normally in social situations. He was severely uncomfortable. And there was even a paranoid flavor to his thinking. It's not just that girls ignored him. In his mind, this became girls took delight in denying him access to them as if they were laughing gleefully at the way they were torturing him, as if they took sadistic pleasure in denying him access to their bodies. So in his mind, there was sort of, again, that distorted reality creeping in.
Exactly. We're talking with Dr. Peter Langman, author of the book Why Kids Kill, Inside the Minds of School Shooters. Dr. Langman has studied the school shooter issue in-depthly, more so than anybody that I've ever come across. And Dr. Langman, you are helping us out tremendously tonight. We do have a couple of questions from the chat room. I just want to ask one thing first, and I'll get to those questions next. As far as Elliot Rogers, he was the latest shooter down at Santa Barbara and inside a small business. I think it was a sandwich shop or something. I can't remember. Anyway, apparently people are saying that his parents knew he was a deeply troubled child, and still they put him out there on his own, set him up in an apartment, and just left him there to explode, basically. Got him out of their way and out of their life and put him into a situation where if he exploded, it wouldn't be around them. Do you think that's a fair assessment, that the parents knew that he was bad and knew that he could do something horrible, yet they still put him in alone with a bunch of other kids, three other kids?
No, that's not how I see it. The parents had no idea that he would explode the way he did. They certainly knew he had his difficulties, and they had arranged, you know, various services for him at different points in his life, including some counselors and, you know, consultations with psychiatrists and so on. So it's not that they ignored his difficulties, but that he never gave away just how disturbed he was. He was able to cover that up very well. And he wanted to experience college life. So he went to college in Southern California, where, you know, he had this idealized view of you know, fun and women, and this is going to be great, and the party life, and so on, because that's what he was so eager, so desperate to experience. So that was his attempt to live the life he wanted to live.
You can check out Dr. Langman's site. It's www.schoolshooters.info, and it is filled with important information that we should all read and learn. Dr. Langman, we have a question from our chat room. This comes from, where did you go? Sword and Scale would like to know whether Dr. Langman thinks we have any hope of ever solving this problem or even making a dent, since a lot of these shooters these days, like Elliot Rogers, were being treated at the same time they flipped out and went on their killing spree.
You know, I think we're making much more of a dent than people are aware of in a couple different ways. First of all, there's many potential school shootings that the country never hears about because they're stopped and it never makes the news. Parents, teachers, whatever, report the child. The child goes to treatment, gets through whatever crisis he or she was in, and we never hear about it. And I know that firsthand because I used to work in a psychiatric hospital for children and adolescents. And that's how I got into doing this work. 10 days after the attack at Columbine, a 16-year-old was admitted to the facility, and I was the one to evaluate and work with him. And over time, I saw many more potential school shooters. Most of them had never made the news. So that was just one facility that happens elsewhere, too. So we are catching a lot that we don't even hear about.
So that's good to know. That's one thing. I mean, please continue.
Now, another issue is difficult to sort out because of the perceptions we have that school shootings are essentially an epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were saying earlier, it didn't seem like these things were happening back in the 70s and 80s. There were a few that I could talk about besides Brenda Spencer. They didn't seem to be happening with the frequency we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at data, we don't have the official government data for the last year or so. But if you look at from 1992 to 2012, that critical 20-year period, school-related homicides have come down dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do we understand that, given what we're seeing in the news? I think one thing that may have happened is in earlier decades, a lot of the school-related homicides were occurring at inner-city schools related to gangs, drugs, etc. And they didn't tend to make the news. Two guys fighting over a drug deal, one shoots the other. It didn't seem like it was a story worthy of the national news.
Mm-hmm.
When a kid walks into a school with a weapon, opens fire indiscriminately, and shoots 10, 15, 20 or more people, that's a different kind of violence, especially when it's happening in small towns and suburbs where they don't have much in the way of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be seeing fewer perpetrators, but when they commit murder, they're committing mass murder, and the violence may be shifting from urban centers into other areas where it just seems that much more striking and harder to explain. And the attacks seem harder to explain.
Understood. Okay. We have another question. This comes from our friend over the ocean, I believe. Why the USA and not other countries? Mrs. Norris does not live in the USA, and the country she lives in, I never hear of any school shooters. Why here so much and nowhere else?
Well, it's not true that it's nowhere else. In my forthcoming book, I include 10 shooters from outside the United States, so that's a significant percentage of mm-hmm. them. I cover 48 in my new book, so 10 of them are not American. Canada has had a surprising number. Germany has had perhaps a surprising number. I also look at ones in Scotland and Brazil and a couple in Finland. So it's not unique to the United States, though we do mm-hmm. seem to have much more frequent large-scale incidents at schools, and no one can say why. You can talk about gun access compared to some countries, because in other countries, there's minimal access to firearms. So that could be one factor. There's also that whole contagion concept that could account for it, that it's kind of gaining a momentum of its own, and some shooters do feed off of other shooters. And many people, for example, look back to Eric Harris at Columbine and take him as a role model. Other shooters have been used as role models, and maybe at this point it's just kind of feeding on itself.
And do you think then the media coverage is a part of the problem, because it doesn't glorify, it doesn't say they're doing something great, but they get a lot of attention, and that's what they're seeking. Is it possible, if we can get the media to dial it back and not report it so much, that maybe it'll go away, or is that just a ridiculous thought?
Well, I don't know that it would go away if the media changed its coverage, but how the media covers these attacks is important, and we saw that perhaps best in the wake of the attack at Virginia Tech. A couple days after the attack, the package Sung Hui Cho had mailed to MSNBC arrived, and it included his so-called multimedia manifesto, which included film clips of him spouting his, you know, raging, hate-filled speech. And MSNBC played that. And there was such an outcry, especially from the parents of the victims, saying, you're giving an international forum to a madman mass murderer. And in response to that, MSNBC stopped airing the videos. But that raises the very issue, you know, how much is the media kind of playing into this phenomenon by giving people so much attention that for people who feel like they're nobody and they want to become a somebody, it's very simple. You get a gun, and you shoot a lot of people, and suddenly the whole world knows who you are.
You are no longer a nobody, and you have power, and you have changed people's lives with your power. I mean, it's all wrapped up into that, isn't it? It's about, it's all about them, and it's about, like you said, making sure that they are seen as having power. Let's move on. We were talking about Elliot Rodgers. There's so many others to discuss. The Jonesboro one, we touched a little bit on that the other night, but I would like to go into that further because I think this is very important for our listeners to understand. And as I mentioned Thursday night in Jonesboro, that was the two killers, Mitch, and I apologize, Andrew. Was that the other name?
Yes. Yep, 11 Mitchell and 13. Thompson and Andrew Golden. Yep.
That's right. And they were 11 and 13 years old. And the 11-year-old was the leader, not the 13-year-old. He was the one that got this going. But I heard a doctor say shortly after that shooting, and he apparently had been involved with the shooters beforehand, not these particular shooters, but other school shooters. And he said every school shooter he had ever met had been sexually abused. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Statement now, or is it even wider than that?
You know, based on my research, I could not support that statement. Some of them have been sexually abused. In some cases, that's better documented than others. One of the categories of shooters I write about is what I call a traumatized school shooter. And Mitchell Johnson of the Jonesboro attack reported after the rampage that he had been raped by an older boy for 4 years. And that, you know, was very severe sexual abuse. There's no indication that Andrew Golden or most other school shooters have been molested. It's always possible. It just hasn't come to light in other cases. But I know of several where there is pretty solid reason to believe they were sexually abused, but I would not say all of them, and not even most of them, based on my research.
This was back in 1999, so perhaps just that he had not interviewed Mitchell or Andrew yet. He was just saying that he wouldn't be surprised if they were sexually abused, because all of the ones he had interviewed, had he ever interviewed, had been sexually abused, and that explains a lot of the anger Okay, so let's take sexual abuse out of the equation now, because we know that's a cause of this, and we need to stop that, and we've got to do a better job as society to protect our children from being sexually abused. We have to report if we have suspicion, on and on. That's a whole other show. Let's just put sexual abuse in a box and move it out of the reasons for school shooters, and let's go back to it. Don't you think that the main reason is, if you have to boil it down to one reason, it is a deep-seated, frothing at the mouth anger at something?
Yes, as I said, you know, a little while ago, if there's something that we could say that would be true for almost all school shooters, it's that they're full of rage. But why they're full of rage varies. For Elliot Rodger, it was because at 22, he was what he called a kissless virgin. He had never had sex. He had never even kissed a girl. And that filled him with rage, rage towards all the women in the world, and rage towards all the men who were succeeding where he wasn't. It's a very different cause than Mitchell Johnson, whose father was physically abusive and had the older boy rape him for 4 years and had all kinds of other chaos and, you know, disruption in his life. So they were both filled with rage, but for very different reasons.
And another rage that we need to look at, too, and that's school bullying. Again, you have one kid on one hand who was bullied without stop, and he turns out to be a successful CEO. And you have other kids that are bullied, and they turn out to be school shooters. Now, supposedly the Columbine kids were bullied. I don't know if that was ever truly determined to be actually true. Was it? Do you know? The two Columbine shooters, were they actually bullied extensively for how they looked and how they dressed?
You know, that's a very complicated question. I have a website, as you mentioned, with an article there called The Search for Truth at Columbine. And one of the things I'm trying to get to the bottom of is, what is the evidence about how much they were picked on, and also how much they picked on others, because it did go both ways. Students did report that Harris and Klebold, more Harris, however, were teased. Now, is teasing bullying? You know, being made fun of in gym class could be hurtful. It may not be as bad as being made fun of and then beaten up after school, and, you know, there were some school shooters who were physically beaten and assaulted repeatedly. I didn't see any evidence of that with Harris and Klebold. They were teased in gym class. They were kind of mocked when they wore their black trench coats and it was 80 degrees outside. That doesn't explain the desire to kill 500 people in your school and commit the worst terrorist attack in the history of the United States. So when people say, well, yeah, they were picked on. Yes, they were. But there were kids at that school who were picked on a lot worse than they were, and probably kids at every school who were picked on worse than they were. So it's hard to say that bullying caused Columbine. I certainly would not say that, but I wouldn't deny that that could have been a factor, that that was part of it. But you have to look at who Eric Harris was as a person to better understand all the forces driving him to violence.
Let's, if you don't mind, Doctor, I find this absolutely fascinating. Let's talk about Eric Harris. He was the leader of the two. He was the one that kind of organized this whole thing. What was his life like? I've never really heard a definitive understanding of what was going on with him, so I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Well, there's what his life was like externally, like with Elliot Rodger, and then there's what was going on inside his mind in terms of his personality. Eric's father was a military man, and that meant Eric had lived in several different states as his father moved from, you know, one base to another. Lots of kids go through that. It is a challenge. You know, you have to make new friends and so on. But Eric even wrote a couple school papers about his childhood. And he wrote about how sad it was to leave his old friends, but then how quickly he made new friends. So in those papers, he did not present that as a traumatic experience. I think to understand Eric Harris, you have to look at his writings. And we have his journal, which I've transcribed from his handwriting. You know, I've typed it. It's on my website. We have some of his school papers. We have web pages of his. And all of these give a window into his personality.
And that's, let me interrupt you in case anybody would like to go to that website. It's www.schoolshooters.info. So please continue, Dr. Langman.
What we see in Eric's personality is a lot of different traits, but notable are the psychopathic ones. He wrote repeatedly about rejecting morality and how words like good and evil have no meaning. You know, mm-hmm. He rejected conventional values. He wanted to do whatever he felt like doing. He had rape fantasies. He had fantasies of dismembering and mutilating human bodies just for the fun of it, which, by the way, Elliot Rodger had sadistic fantasies as well that he wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the sadism, you see the narcissism, same way Elliot Rodger wrote about being God. Eric Harris liked to write in people's yearbooks, "Ich bin Gott," which is German for "I am God."
What? Why, though? What happened to him as a child that created this monster? Something had to flip in his brain. What could it possibly be?
One possibility, well, we could talk about psychopathic personalities in general.
Okay.
And how much, and then we could come back to Eric Harris. How's that?
That sounds good.
Okay. Perhaps the world authority on psychopaths, or one of them anyway, is Dr. Robert Hare, H-A-R-E. And he talks about the nature versus nurture element.
Mm-hmm.
And at least among the psychopaths he studied, and he studied them for decades, he tends to come down on the side that psychopaths are born that way. They're biologically different. Now, they're shaped by their environment. If they grow up in a basically supportive, functional family, they may go on to be white-collar psychopaths, maybe, you know, corporate executives, politicians, whatever, who know how to manipulate people, deceive them, but never commit an act of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Or they might grow up in a more violent, dysfunctional family, which would increase the likelihood that they would become violent psychopaths.
Okay.
But he writes about how even at the level of brain waves and nervous system responses, if you hook them up to electrodes and so on, you're going to see different things, that mm-hmm. at the biological level, they're different.
So what would happen? Oh, I'm sorry. Please continue.
Okay. Just to go back to Eric Harris, however, there could be other factors. One of the ones I wrote about in my book, Why Kids Kill, is the idea of the compensatory narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
As I said about Elliot Rodger, there was a profound inferiority, but he seemed to compensate for that by going into these fantasies of being a godlike being.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, Eric Harris may have had some profound feelings of inferiority, and you even get glimpses of those in his journal, where he writes about his self-hatred, about his looks and lack of confidence with girls, which is striking because most of his journal is full of this kind of narcissistic, blustering grandiosity.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another thing I've noticed. Yes?
No, go ahead.
Another interesting thing I've noticed among a lot of the school shooters is what you might call biological challenges to their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been research connecting violent behavior with minor biological anomalies, low birth weight, birth complications, etc. Eric Harris had two birth defects, and just about nobody writes about these.
What are they?
One was something to do with his legs, and he had maybe a dozen appointments or more with physicians about his legs when he was a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
The other one, perhaps even more significant, was he had a chest deformity. Nor was he the only school shooter to have a chest deformity.
So that pigeon deformity where the chest is concave, is that what you're talking about?
One of the shooters had the concave, the other had the convex chest deformity.
Okay.
So Eric had a sunken chest. He had it. Mm-hmm. He had surgery when he was 12, and the metal strut was implanted. And then at age 13, after he had grown a bit, the strut was removed. But given that, you know, his father was a military man, Eric had military aspirations of his own. His brother was a successful athlete. Eric felt small, skinny, he had a deformed chest. To be manly, you need a big, powerful chest. And I just wonder how much of Eric's narcissism may have been his way of trying to achieve masculinity or manhood to compensate for feeling damaged, especially when you look at many other school shooters and realized they were unusually short, they had a birth defect, a chest deformity, something else that might have made it hard for them to feel they had a, you know, a masculine sense of self.
What do you think was wrong with Eric's legs?
That I don't know, but if you go through the 20,000-plus pages of Jefferson County Sheriff Office documents, all of which are on my website, by the way, you come across a couple pages noting, you know, appointments related to the leg problem, but I didn't see a diagnosis.
Ah, okay.
But Eric grew up to be a successful soccer player. He played soccer for Columbine High School for 2 years, played in another league or two outside of the school. So by the time he was older, his legs apparently were fine.
So let's look at it this way, and correct me if I'm wrong here. You have a small child, and everyone needs to remember our brains are not fully formed till we're in our 20s. I mean, they're still growing and changing, but at a very young age, certain connections are made in the brain. And again, doctor, stop me if I'm wrong here. Certain connections are made in the brain. So at a very young age, if Eric Harris thought he was had a defect, he was a defective child, his brain wouldn't know how to deal with that information, his subconscious, whatever, wouldn't know how to deal with that. So it would do all kinds of mental gymnastics, and eventually what would come out would be this narcissistic personality. Is that a good way to describe it?
That's one possibility, yes.
And what's the other?
You know, a lot of personality is just inherited. People come into the world with a temperament.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, Robert Hare tends to think psychopaths are born. It could be largely biological and less psychological, but I think in the case of Eric Harris, there was probably some significant psychological forces driving him to do what he did.
And again, I think people need to realize that when you have young children and you are very cruel to them, I'm not even saying physically, I'm just talking words here, people. When you're really cruel to them, it can affect them their whole life and not even know why. They don't know why they turned out this way, but it could be some horrible thing that an abusive adult did to them that I'm not saying they turn out to be a school shooter, but my point is, you can't be cruel to small children. It can really affect them later in their life. And so if you are with someone that's cruel to your kids, get the hell out of there. That's a whole other show that we can do on that. Okay, Dr. Langman, we're talking with Dr. Peter Langman. I would highly recommend you check out his website, and that is www.schoolshooters.info. It has everything there, including the 20,000-page report on Columbine. So, doctor, you have done so much good work, and now we need to jump forward and look at the future. We now know, as a society and teachers and parents know, that when a kid says, I'm going to bring a gun to school and shoot everybody up, that we should report it. Doesn't happen, but we know now that's a real bad sign. Somebody draws a picture of a kid killing another, of a, you know, stick figure killing another stick figure. There you go. That's a sign. You need to intervene to make sure that there's nothing going on with that child. I guess what I'm trying to say is there are the obvious signs that we now know, lay people in the community, we now know what we need to watch out for. Apparently, since there are school shootings going on, there are some signs being missed. Do we know what those signs are yet?
You know, it's hard to say what's been missed. Sometimes we find out afterwards that there were a lot of rather obvious warning signs, at least obvious in hindsight. Some shooters are much more careful about not leaving a trail, so it's possible that some of these attacks did not have, you know, the same long line of warning signs that some of the attacks do. So it's hard to know if people were missing either obvious or not so obvious warning signs. Mm-hmm. You know, if we could just get people to respond to the obvious ones, we would be taking a giant step forward.
So that's still a problem then, that some people are not responding to the obvious ones and we have school shootings. So is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's my impression, that some people have the attitude, well, you know, it can't happen here. They may have the attitude, well, yeah, the kid said that, but look how young he is. Or I know the kid, and I know the family, it's a good kid, it's a good family. There's all kinds of ways people can dismiss a potential warning sign.
Okay, I have a two-part question for you, Doctor. Dr. Peter Langman, expert in school shootings. We're talking about how to avoid them, what signs. We know the obvious signs, at least we think we do, but they're still being ignored. But let's say you're a parent and you have a 10-year-old kid and you find several drawings in where he's stabbing somebody else in those pictures, and it's drawn like a 10-year-old. Do you rush them to a shrink? Do you keep him locked up until you know he's okay? What do you do?
You know, a kid drawing violent pictures might be just a kid drawing violent pictures.
Exactly. That's my point. They do stuff like that. That's gory and bloody all the time. How do you differentiate between that?
Well, if you have concerns, you know, I don't know that you have to rush him to a shrink, but, you know, schedule an appointment with a mental health professional or, you know, talk to people at school. Is he making violent statements? Is he talking mm-hmm. about wanting to kill people? Is he writing or drawing things at school? You know, how widespread is this? Was it just one drawing based on a movie or TV show he saw that day? Or is this an ongoing theme? And also, is this someone who's depressed and could be suicidal even at age 10? Is it someone full of rage? Is he acting out? Is he engaging in cruelty to animals, maybe torturing or killing pets or other animals? You know, you want to start gathering information
mm-hmm.
because it could be a warning sign or it could just be a kid, you know, drawing what he saw on a TV show that day.
Exactly.
But parents,
oh, please continue.
Parents shouldn't feel that they have to be the ones to make that determination. They should get school involved, the mental health system, if it seems warranted, or the school may recommend that, or maybe they can look into it at their end and have someone talk to the child.
Okay, second part question. You have a kid who's 18, and he's moved out, he's got his own job, and you find out that you come upon a journal or something that he's written that is horribly dark and terrible and talks about, you know, killing people at work and killing innocent people and killing babies, and he's 18. What can you do?
You can call your local law enforcement because mm-hmm. if there's evidence of potential violence, if there's something that constitutes terroristic threats, you know, that's a violation of the law. And once there's a violation of law or a potential one, having law enforcement involved can be critical because the parents may not have access to, you know, the child's room. He may be, like you said, living elsewhere. Police can get a search warrant if it seems to be necessary and go in, get the journal, confiscate the computer, you know, search for bombs, guns. Once law enforcement gets involved, there's so much more potential for stopping an attack. So if that journal is violent enough or suggestive of enough that there's an impending rampage coming, get law enforcement involved. You know, a mental health professional is not going to be able to do anything because the kid mm-hmm. is 18 and could refuse to even talk to somebody. But get the law involved.
So that's a pretty drastic thing, though. I think it would be difficult as a parent if you saw something where maybe he just wrote a feeling like, you know, I hate Jim at work. He makes me sick. One day I'll get even with him. I'll kill him. Oh, my God, what do you do? Is it just a kid writing down thoughts, or is it a terroristic threat? I guess it's hard to – you just have to judge as a parent, right? I mean, there's no black and white line, is there?
There's not, but you have to think of the consequences. if you overreact and it turns out not to be a planned rampage, all right, so police talk to them or, you know, do a search. They find nothing. Let them go. No charges filed. It's okay. If you underreact, though, and he goes ahead and kills Jim and other people at work and so on, and you knew he was thinking about that, you know, how do you live with that for the rest of your life? And what happens to your child then? Most likely he's dead or in jail till he dies. And, you know, you have to think through, all right, he might be mad if I call the police and it's nothing. On the other hand, if I don't call the police and he is planning something, he's going to be dead or in jail for the rest of his life. And I'm going to have to live with the guilt that people died because I did not take action. Mm-hmm. So you need to really think it through.
And that's just it, the what if. Boy, that would be hard, though, because, you know, the kid is going to say, Mom, I was just, you know, writing out my feelings. Isn't that what you want me to do, is to write things out how I feel? I would never do that. But you're right. You have to look at the consequences. The what ifs. And, boy, that would keep a parent up at night no matter what. Let's talk a little bit about the very, very early warning signs, Dr. Langman. Let's say... We talked on my show Thursday, the youngest school shooter that actually got a gun and took it to school to shoot somebody was a six-year-old, obviously having no idea of the consequences of his actions or the finality of death and all of that. He had just seen people shoot other people on TV, and it made them be dead, so he wanted his classmate dead. I think it had to do with a girl, didn't it, or am I mistaken?
He shot a girl who was five.
And so what signs would be there with that six-year-old that the parents could have seen?
You know, from what I recall of the case, it was an extremely dysfunctional family life. So the parents may have been totally inadequate in terms of supervision and care. You know, I talked earlier about the traumatized school shooters. I think this six-year-old boy would fit in that category. In that category, you almost always have at least one parent with severe alcohol and or drug abuse, maybe both parents, and there's usually physical abuse. And even though abuse can occur at all levels of society, when you look at the traumatized shooters, typically they're coming from the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum. So on top of everything else, there's poverty, and they often move around a lot, and the kids bounce from one parent to another, to a grandparent, to foster care, and so on. So there's not just abuse, but just chronic instability. So in those situations, you know, the parents are not keeping a proper eye on the kids. The parents may be the central problem in the kids' lives. So if there, there are warning signs, the parents are probably not going to see them or respond appropriately.
Because they're already messed up in their own messed up, twisted world, which is why the kid is the way he is in the first place. And then I think that's where neighbors and teachers and people that have contact with the family come in. But how do you predict a six-year-old taking a gun and killing somebody? I don't think anybody could see that one coming at all. Dr. Langman, let's get back to Columbine for just a moment. We talked a lot about Eric Harris and his life, how he was born with some deformities. His father was in the military. He moved around a lot. He had a successful older brother. He had to have surgery to correct the deformity in his chest. Let's talk about Klebold for a moment, his buddy. He was the follower. Klebold was the follower, just kind of did whatever Harris said. What was Klebold's family life like? What were his problems?
You know, I don't know that Klebold had family problems. In fact, at one point, he wrote in his journal about all the things good in his life. And that included a good family. Now, later on, he did complain that his brother, as he put it, ripped on him a lot, you know, teased him or picked on him.
Well, yeah, you know, but that's normal.
You know. But regarding his parents, Klebold, I don't know that, I can't say he never said a word against them, but there was no indication that they were problematic or, you know, deficient as parents in any significant way. I think Klebold came into the world with a certain personality. And we have reports of him going way back to childhood. He was just chronically anxious, socially insecure, kind of inept, lacking confidence, couldn't take initiative, needed other kids to tell him what to do. Like, he was afraid to assert himself, even to say, hey, let's go play this or that. So always a follower, very dependent on others. And apparently during adolescence, he just shrunk within himself. If you read his journal, it's a very strange document. And until his journal was released by the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, I didn't know what to make of Klebold. He looked like, all right, so he's depressed, he's kind of anxious, you know, shy. How does that explain mass murder?
Yeah, exactly.
But when his journal was released, it really gives a window into just how strange his internal world was. Mm-hmm. And he, too, wrote about himself as not being human, being a godlike being, but it was full of loneliness and anguish, suicidal thoughts, you know, longing for love. It's interesting to compare his to Eric Harris's journal. Now, Harris drew swastikas and guns. Dylan drew hearts. You know, he wrote about love. Harris wrote about hate. Dylan, you know, drawing hearts and, you know, mooning over the girls he's in love with. Harris is writing about raping girls. He's writing about Nazis, Hitler, just very different orientations. So.
Let's talk about Eric Harris. I just noticed there was a question in the chat room from a while back. Dr. Lyman, you were talking about Eric Harris having a chest deformity, and one of our listeners wants to know, what is a concave or convex chest? What are those deformities that two of the school shooters had, one of them being Eric Harris?
Eric Harris had what was technically known as pectus excavatum, which is a sunken chest. So, you know, kind of a depressed chest. Whereas Robert Poulin, that's P-O-U-L-I-N, a Canadian shooter from 1975, had pectus carinatum, which is a so-called pigeon chest, a convex chest, one that sticks out inappropriately.
And I'm sure you can Google those terms and see pictures. But interesting that two of the shooters would have what I would think would be fairly uncommon type deformities, don't you think?
It's very striking. And what's even more striking is I see them as both psychopathic shooters. They both committed their attacks at age 18. And they both had fathers who were retired Air Force pilots.
I seem to be hearing a lot the father was in the military. Is that a semi-common thread here that we're seeing, or is it just a couple of particular cases?
No, that struck me, too, as I was doing my research, and I write about that in my forthcoming book. Not just fathers, but some older male or occasionally female relative in the military. And the significance of that might be if you have an older male who's a successful soldier, and you have military aspirations of your own, or you're insecure about your masculinity, and you want to join the military, you're trying to follow in their footsteps, and you fail. That's a profound blow to one's identity. And not only did a lot of shooters have relatives in the military, a lot of the shooters had military aspirations of their own that were thwarted. Either they applied, tried to enlist, and were rejected, or they got in and were quickly discharged or left, you know, had some strings pulled to get out, or they were denied the opportunity to even apply from a number of different circumstances. So you see a lot of relatives in the military and a lot of failed military ambitions. And a lot of people, I think, trying to establish a sense of manhood among themselves. How do you do that? How do you feel powerful? Violence is a way to do it. A number
Unfortunately.
Of them, yeah, wrote about getting guns and feeling powerful. Eric Harris said, you know, the day he got his guns, you know, I feel more powerful, more confident, more godlike.
Yes.
And a lot of them use that kind of language.
Dr. Langman, we do have to wrap things up. You've been so gracious. You've given us more than an hour. Tell us about your new book that's coming out in about 7 months. I know that seems like a long way away, but it's going to be fantastic. What is the name of it, and what are you writing about?
Okay, the name is School Shooters, Understanding High School, College, and Adult Perpetrators. And this continues my line of research from my book, Why Kids Kill, but it's much expanded. Instead of 10 shooters, I look at 48 shooters. Instead of just American shooters, I look at 10 international cases. I look at secondary school shooters as one group. I look at college and university shooters as another group. And I've added the category of what I call aberrant adult shooters. Mm-hmm. These are people such as Elliot Rodger or Adam Lanza who commit attacks either at schools they never attended at all or attended years before. So Elliot Rodger attacked a school he never attended. Adam mm-hmm. Lanza went back to Sandy Hook. He had gone there, you know, as a young child. He was now a 20-year-old adult gunning down 6-year-old children. So I look at, you know, 11 attacks by what I call aberrant adults. So mm-hmm. we may think of school shooters typically being students at the schools they attack. They often are, but not always.
Not always. And, of course, you have your book out that everybody should get, Why Kids Kill, Inside the Mind of School Shooters. And then everybody, you have to, I would make this a requirement if I were king of the world, but I'm not. Go to Dr. Langman's website, www.schoolshooters.info. Everything you need to know is right there on that website. Dr. Peter Langman, thank you so much. You have been so courteous and so kind to give us so much of your time. And I will call upon you again. You are now going to be a regular guest, whether you like it or not. So we'll be calling you back real soon, okay?
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Langman. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
What a great guy. Oh, Dr. Peter Langman, definitely somebody that's going to, we're going to go to him. He's our go-to guy when it comes to shooters like this. So very nice, very gracious. He didn't have to give up his Sunday afternoon on Father's Day or Sunday evening, but he did because he's just a nice guy. We had lots of great people in chat tonight. I'm so sure glad you joined us. We're going to be back next week. And our guest will be, I don't know, but you know I'll find somebody interesting. And don't forget, the show today is brought to you by the Doris Day Animal Foundation. This is a nonprofit organization founded by the movie star Doris Day. She literally put her money where her mouth was and put up a sanctuary for unwanted pets. She gets them off the streets and gets them adopted out. Go to the website www.dorisdayanimalfoundation.org. Opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. And do remember that we are a complete separate entity from websleuths.com LLC and forumsforjustice.org. Okay? Okay. Don't forget Thursday, it's Trisha's True Crime Radio on the iHeartRadio Network. And I know it's confusing. I have two places with two different shows. iHeartRadio Network. If you go to iHeart.com, guess what? You can't find it. But if you go to iHeart.com and type in Extreme Talk, that's where I show up at 8 o'clock every Thursday night, 8 o'clock Eastern. We're in Wikipedia. If you go to Wikipedia and put in Extreme Talk, it has a big page on us. I'm at the very bottom with one sentence. Oh, well, what can you expect? Anyway, thank you for joining me tonight. I'll see you Thursday night on the radio. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crimes, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.